Today we're talking about the unusual and largely unknown story of resistance to the Nazis in Belorussia, where there was an unprecedented solidarity and help between Jews and non-Jews. My guest, Barbara Epstein, is professor in the History of Consciousness Department at UC Santa Cruz and the author of The Minsk Ghetto, 1941 to 1943, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism, recently published by UC Press. So, Barbara, then, the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. They, as you said, the Red Army withdrew very quickly in a great amount of disarray. So what did the Nazis actually do in Minsk once they had seized control of the city?
Well, the first thing they did was to bomb the city, bomb the center of the city. Then they took control of the city, which meant taking control of the of City Hall, the administrative apparatus, and so forth. They ordered all men between the ages of 15 and 45 to register. They took them off to a hastily constructed outdoor camp outside the city. There they separated Jews from non-Jews, and among Jews they separated Jewish intellectuals, those who worked with their heads rather than their hands, put them in trucks, took them off, and shot them. About 5,000 Jewish intellectuals were shot. They then tried to determine who the communists were among the rest of the Jews and killed those whom they could determine were communists. And after that, Jews were ordered to go into the ghetto, which had been hastily constructed.
So then perhaps you could describe how did the resistance emerge in the face of that repression?
The same thing happened inside the ghetto and outside the ghetto, which was communists who had managed to survive the initial German onslaught began quietly seeking each other out and forming secret groups. Secret groups of communists and also, in some cases, Komsomol members of the communist youth group, formed inside the ghetto and began gradually to make contact with each other. And meanwhile, similar groups were forming outside the ghetto among Belarusian communists. There were some Jews, particularly young people, who had remained outside the ghetto, counting on their non-Jewish looks and the loyalty of their friends. And there was one teenager who had a Jewish teenager who had remained outside the ghetto, who often went into the ghetto to visit his family, and who encountered the underground and put the Jewish underground inside the ghetto in touch with the non-Jewish underground outside the ghetto. Now, in both cases, the underground had not yet gelled. What we're talking about is networks of secret groups on both sides of the ghetto fence. But in the ghetto was formed on August 1st of 1941. There was a secret meeting held outside the ghetto in either late November or early December of 1941, at which the ghetto was represented and at which a Minsk-wide underground was formed.
Again, perhaps we could compare that with the Warsaw Ghetto. Again, the experience of the Jewish resistance within the ghetto was very different, I believe.
Yes. Well, it was different in many respects. It was different, first of all, in that the Warsaw Ghetto underground was inside the ghetto, period. There were no allies of any significance outside the ghetto. Communists, by the way, tried outside the ghetto, tried to help, but the Communist Party was so weak that it was not able to give substantial help.
Can you talk more? Because I think that's one of the significant factors is that, as your book demonstrates and elucidates, the degree of cooperation between both the ghetto and outside of the ghetto within the respective underground resistance movements mm-hmm. and the overlap between them. There was very, as you're saying, a huge demarcation in Poland and in the Warsaw Ghetto between the Jewish resistance and the non-Jewish resistance.
Right. This was actually true both in Poland and in Lithuania. In Poland, the situation was even worse in that the Home Army, which was the main wing of the resistance, was worried that a rebellion might take place inside the ghetto because they were afraid that this could spark a rebellion throughout Poland against German rule. They did not want this to happen until German rule was on the way to collapse. And the reason for that was they were afraid that a rebellion, particularly a rebellion sparked by a ghetto uprising, might tilt in the direction of support of an alliance with the Red Army and support for communism. The Home Army was conservative, anti-communist, and it did not want to see Poland tilt in the direction of communism. And it was for these political reasons that the Home Army refused to give any substantial aid to the underground inside the ghetto and, in fact, betrayed the ghetto at the moment when an uprising did take place.
So again, you've talked that from its inception of the underground, both within and without the ghetto, there was close cooperation. Perhaps you could talk a little, of course, because there was the organized resistance finding each other. But of course, there was, as you write about in the book, there was all kinds of non-organized and non-systemic cooperation going on between Jews and Belarusians.
Actually, this gets back to another difference between the Minsk ghetto and the ghettos in Poland and Lithuania. The policy of the underground movement in the Minsk ghetto was not to organize an armed rebellion inside the ghetto, but instead to find ways of sending as many Jews as possible to partisan units in the forest. This strategy was extremely popular with the Jewish population of the Minsk ghetto because the opportunity it held out was to fight the Germans and possibly survive. And the difference was that the strategy of that was the dominant strategy in the ghettos on the part of the underground movements in the ghettos of Poland and Lithuania, which was to mobilize an armed rebellion, led towards death. And so, as you can imagine, that was less popular among the population. And so there were many Jews. One ghetto survivor told me that he thought that probably every Jew in the ghetto, other than children, had at one point or another thought of trying to escape the ghetto and go to the partisans. And a very high proportion of Jews in the ghetto did try to do that. And the fact that the ghetto underground was organizing such efforts meant that the underground was paving the way for a flight to the partisan units on the part of ordinary Jews in the ghetto who were outside the underground.
My guest today is Barbara Epstein. She's the author of The Minsk Ghetto, 1941-43, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism. So we're talking about the crucial role played by the partisans. Perhaps at this point you could talk a little about the role of the partisans in the forest. I mean, who were they and why were they so important?
The partisans had begun with the small groups of Red Army soldiers who found themselves trapped on occupied territory, who formed bands and went to the forest. But as German repression increased in Belarus, both Jews and non-Jews increasingly wanted to join the partisan units. One can think of it as being a little bit like what happened in Vietnam. As the partisans took control of more and more of the forest in Belarus, the Germans took the attitude that villages in partisan territory were supporters of the partisans, and they began trying to destroy those peasant villages. That kind of German brutality, of course, turned Belarusians against the Germans to an even greater degree than they had been against the Germans previously. And so it was a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. The more the Germans fought the partisans, the more both Belarusians and Jews wanted to join the partisans.
Also, I believe that because of the terrain, as you describe it, is very heavily forested, it was not only perfect partisan country or guerrilla warfare country, but also it was a large swathe of the country, was it not?
the partisan forest became an increasingly large area of Belarus. Plus, I think the Germans were stretched much thinner than they thought they would be. By this time, the Germans were engaged in bitter fighting on the front, and they didn't really have the troops to keep the Belarusian population under control. And the result was that instead of trying to win over the Belarusian population, they adopted policies of repression.
Perhaps you could illustrate with when you went to what is now Belarus, to what was then Belorussia. Of course, you interviewed many of the survivors of the ghetto and folks that fought with partisans. Perhaps you could use a story to describe what actually that meant on the ground then, in terms of being smuggled out of the ghetto, finding these partisan bands, and again, some of the incredible work that the partisan bands did. I'm particularly drawn by the story of the fact that the partisans, that they actually had a band that was comprised primarily of women and children, i.e. a non-combatant aspect of that partisan band.
Right. The story of that unit, that was Zorin's brigade, is a good illustration of the kind of cooperation that went on in Belarus between Jews and non-Jews. What happened was that in the spring of 1942, members of the ghetto underground who were working in a German concentration camp in Minsk discovered that there was a Red Army lieutenant in the concentration camp, and they decided to get him out. Now, this was a woman named Sonia Kurlanskaya, who was a member of the ghetto underground, had gotten the job as the translator and secretary to the German head of the concentration camp, who, of course, did not know that she was a member of the underground, obviously. And there were also several members of the underground who worked in the concentration camp doing menial work, including taking garbage out of the ghetto, out of the concentration camp. The reason the underground had sent them into this concentration camp was to help Red Army soldiers to escape from the concentration camp and help them get to the partisans. A group of Jews had recently been sent to the forest. They had joined with a group of Belarusians, and this unit needed a leader. And so Kurlanskaya decided that Ganzenko, the Red Army lieutenant, should be sent to the partisan forest to become the leader of this unit. They put him and a bunch of other Red Army soldiers into garbage cans filled with garbage, loaded them onto trucks, drove them out of the concentration camp, let them off at a pre-decided spot along the way where they were met by a Jewish liaison from the partisan unit who led them to the partisan unit in the forest. Ganzenko, whose life had been saved by the Jewish underground, then rose to become a powerful leader within the partisan movement. And in 1943, when many Jews were escaping from the ghetto and wandering around in the forest and in danger of dying in the forest, several members of the ghetto underground, who by this time were in the partisan movement, went to Ganzenko and asked that he create a special unit for the protection of Jewish women and children who could not fight. Ganzenko agreed to do this, and he donated 18 of his fighters to protect the unit. Eventually, this unit included probably 600 to 700 people, and they all survived the war. From a military point of view, this was extremely unusual. What this meant was that military resources were being used to protect civilians and Jews, of course. I cannot imagine this story having taken place any place but in Belarusia.
Well, I think, again, the importance to stress about that is, as you pointed out earlier, the typical, if you like, historical model of Jewish resistance, of the ghetto uprising, as you pointed out, was, in effect, glorious suicide. Heroic, mm-hmm. but it was a suicidal gesture, literally. When they were smuggling out initially, of course, Jews from the Minsk ghetto to join the partisan bands. Initially, of course, these would have been people that were able to join the partisans as fighters. So as you point out, the tangential shift here was actually they started smuggling out and working with basically non-combatants to try and save not just those that could carry arms. So perhaps briefly then, as you said, that your book ends in 1943, and there's no coincidence in that was the end of the Minsk ghetto. What happened then?
By the time the Germans decided to destroy the Minsk ghetto, there were only about 2,000 people living in it. The Germans had conducted a series of pogroms in the ghetto in which they killed thousands of Jews. So between the numbers who had been killed in the ghetto and the numbers who had escaped to the partisans, hardly anyone was left.
So to recap, I believe the ghetto started off with 100,000 members, and you're saying the estimates are perhaps 10,000 were spirited away to the partisans.
Well, 10,000 managed to reach and join partisan units. Probably for every Jew who managed to join a partisan unit, two more died along the way.
Apropos to the subtitle of your book, talking about nationalism as you have been, internationalism, and we were examining earlier those three planks, if you like, of competing planks at the time on the ground between Zionism, communism, and the Labour Bund. Why then, after the fact, shall we say, is the story of the Minsk ghetto, which is perhaps the most successful in terms of lives saved and of impact, example of resistance, why is this story not known, whereas the world is, the Warsaw ghetto?
Well, I think there are both practical reasons and political reasons. The practical reason is that survivors of the ghettos in Poland and Lithuania tended to come to the United States or go to Palestine after the war, where they wrote their memoirs. Survivors of the Minsk ghetto, on the whole, remained in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was, after the war, was unfriendly to hearing this story for two reasons. One was, by that time, the anti-cosmopolitan campaign was in full swing. That's a polite way of saying a shift towards a policy of anti-Semitism. Discussion of the special persecution of Jews during the war was not considered okay in the Soviet Union, which meant that it was virtually impossible to publish anything about the ghetto. Jewish organizations in the United States and in Palestine and then Israel wanted to celebrate the resistance movements that their members had participated in. And that meant that Zionist organizations celebrated the Warsaw Ghetto, the Vilna Ghetto, and so forth, because those ghetto uprisings had been Zionist-led. There was nobody with a similar stake in talking about what had happened in Minsk. And I think the last reason was in the United States, first of all, the United States preferred a narrative of the war in which the war had really been a conflict between the United States and Nazi Germany, and in which the Soviet Union had been, we didn't like to talk about the Soviet Union having anything to do with it. And this was also a period in which mainstream Jewish organizations in the United States wanted to forget about the historically strong connection between Jews and the left, including Jews and communism, and the story of the Minsk ghetto, in which Jews had participated in a communist-led resistance movement, was the last thing that most Jewish organizations wanted to hear about. So the result of this was nobody wanted to hear about it, either in the United States, Israel, or the Soviet Union.
I'd like to, again, perhaps have you expound a little in the few remaining minutes on two of those points. One, that within the Soviet Union, as you said, not only was this marked shift towards a more open and virulent anti-Semitic strain, but as you detail in your book, there was also the problem that not just Jews faced, but those that had been under Nazi occupation within the Soviet Union, the presumption was that they were collaborators. So that not only were the Jews stigmatized post-1945 mm-hmm. for being Jews, but it, the presumption, the default presumption, was they had also been collaborators.
Right. The Soviet view of those who had lived under German occupation during the war was guilty until proven innocent. And this attitude was carried out particularly in relation to the Minsk underground as a whole, which was accused of collaboration with the Germans both during the war and after the war. A more than 100 surviving members of the Minsk underground were thrown into labor camps, where they remained until 1960, when a leader of the ghetto underground managed to win a long drawn out campaign for the rehabilitation of the Minsk underground.
Again, as you detail in the book, it was a further embarrassment to the Soviet authorities because, as you said and as we discussed, the Soviet authorities, the top-level bureaucrats, fled en masse when the Germans invaded.
That's right. The Minsk underground was organized without the authorization of the Soviet authorities or the communist authorities. It was organized, it was a rank-and-file effort organized by rank-and-file communists who knew, by the way, that they were taking a risk by organizing an underground movement without the authorization of higher-ups. And as it turned out, they were right. This was seen as an act of insubordination by the communist authorities.
So again, the corollary of that, as you were saying, was outside of the Soviet Union, that the Zionist propagation, if you like, of the ghetto uprising side of the resistance, mm-hmm. shall we say, served a very particular Zionist project post-1945.
Right. Well, this reinforced the view that Jews need their own state. It reinforced the view that anti-Semitism had been uniform and blanket throughout Eastern Europe in particular, and that the only solution was the formation of a Jewish state. Now, one thing I would say about that is that, in fact, it was the case that the best solution for Jews at the time of the war was to get out. I think the problem was not so much in that strategy, which in fact was the most effective strategy for Jews, but in the assumption that things could not be otherwise.
I'm afraid that that is all we have time for today. I have been speaking with Barbara Epstein. She's the author of The Minsk Ghetto, 1941 to 1943, Jewish Resistance and Soviet Internationalism, just recently published by UC Press. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.